This is Fresh Air. At last June's International AIDS Conference, organizers vowed to not hold the 1992 conference in Boston as planned unless the U.S. government lifted its immigration ban on people infected with the AIDS virus. The policy, which was then under review, prohibits foreigners who are HIV positive from entering the country, with some exceptions for certain short-term travelers. The government upheld the ban, so conference organizers moved the 1992 AIDS conference to Amsterdam. My guest is the chairman of the 92 conference, Dr. Jonathan Mann. He's the director of the Harvard AIDS Institute's International AIDS Center and the former director of the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS. Last August, he founded the Global AIDS Policy Coalition. Mann says that Harvard University, the organizer of the 92 conference, decided to move the conference because the United States immigration policy is discriminatory.
Harvard took the decision to look for a site elsewhere, look for partners in another country where we could build the conference together in another place, specifically so that the conference and the progress against AIDS that it represents would not become hostage to any single government's discriminatory policy. And so this is the basis of the decision to move. Now, I think that it's really quite a powerful gesture and symbol that the oldest university in the United States, in order to host a conference, an international conference, on a major worldwide epidemic, has to leave the country. And I think that we're not abandoning our fight against those discriminatory U.S. policies that caused us to move the conference. But the conference is important for the world, not just for the United States. We must remember that the U.S. bears about one-tenth of the world's AIDS burden. And so as important as the problem has been and is and will be in this country, we have to be sensitive and aware of the way in which the conference serves the world community. So we're moving it to save it, but we're not forgetting about the need to try to change this U.S. policy, which singles out the U.S. among all the industrialized countries. We're the only country of the industrialized world that has this kind of barrier to the entry of infected people.
The International AIDS Conference was moved from Boston to the Netherlands. Would you compare the Netherlands' policies on AIDS and AIDS prevention with America's?
Yeah. In fact, when we decided to try to look for a partner abroad, we looked very widely, but very quickly realized that the Dutch, in many respects, were a terrific partner, so that it's really not a marriage of convenience between Harvard and the Dutch. It's really a marriage of the heart and of the mind. The Dutch have very forward-looking policies on AIDS. They, first of all, have absolutely no restriction on the entry of HIV-infected people, either for short-term or for long-term visits or immigration. So there is no restriction on that level at all. Secondly, their AIDS policy in general has been characterized by a lot of innovation, a lot of creativity, and a lot of working together between the government and the community organizations, something that has occurred in this country, but not nearly as much as one would hope. In addition, though, to their whole attitude towards AIDS, the Dutch have had historically a very positive and very active positive view towards human rights and towards the developing world. I mean, remembering that this is an international AIDS conference, the fact that in the Netherlands, the Dutch give about four times more on a proportional basis of their gross national product to help the developing world than the United States does is another indication of their internationalism, their attitudes towards human rights, and their attitudes towards AIDS, all of which make this work together and holding the conference in Amsterdam in July of 92. If we had to move the conference, I can't think of a better place to work together with and to move it to than to Amsterdam.
The Netherlands has needle exchange programs and things like that.
Well, they have a lot of things. You know, they have needle exchange programs. They really were they were the innovators, really, of that approach. In addition to that, they have a variety of ways of helping to care for people who are infected or who are ill, including the creation of what they call AIDS cafes in Amsterdam, where people who are infected can go and can get counseling, but basically also just be with other people that understand the problems that they're facing. There's a spirit of tolerance about HIV infection and AIDS in Amsterdam, which really makes the case, if you will, because many of us have felt very strongly that a supportive, tolerant approach to HIV and its control was going to be more effective than a coercive approach. And the Dutch really, in many respects, provide the evidence in practice to support that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Mann. He's a professor of epidemiology and international health at the Harvard School of Public Health. He also directs the International AIDS Center at Harvard's International AIDS Institute. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Jonathan Mann is my guest, and he is the chair of the 1992 International AIDS Conference, which will be held in the Netherlands. There's a new National Commission on AIDS, which recently issued its first report, and the report criticized President Bush's lack of leadership on the question of AIDS. What do you look for in a president to do in times like an epidemic like AIDS?
Well, I actually had the opportunity when I was the director of the World Health Organization's AIDS program from 86 to 90 to work with government leaders around the world. And I can tell you first, right away, it's very important to say that the AIDS programs around the world are divided essentially into two categories, those where there has been national leadership and those where there has not. And there's no question that where national leaders have spoken out, where they have taken positions about AIDS, where they have expressed concern, where they have indicated that this is an important issue in the country, and that they have offered their support for tolerance and for an approach to this problem which will bring people together instead of driving people apart from each other. When that happens and where that happens, you have a qualitatively different kind of program than you have in the other countries. And in the United States, despite the remarkable and extraordinary efforts of people like Everett Koop, of people like Admiral James Watson, of people like June Osborne of the current National Commission on AIDS, despite their efforts, with all that they've done, which is extraordinary, the silence that comes from the top, unfortunately, speaks very loudly. And what is needed are statements, clear statements, repetitive statements, messages to people that say that a problem that has killed more than 100,000 Americans since 1981 is a serious national problem, a problem which we must work together to solve, and then for that person as a leader to not only put into words, but into deeds and into symbols what this means. For example, when the Pope went to San Francisco and embraced a child who was HIV infected, that picture probably did more to reduce fears about the spread of HIV infection through casual contact around the world than any number of words could have done. We need similar images as well as similar words, and this is the kind of inspiration and societal message that only a leader, only the man or woman at the top can provide. And unfortunately, we've not had this in this country from the very beginning of the epidemic until now.
You're always looking at AIDS from an international perspective. If you look at the issue globally, do the priorities become different than if you look at AIDS in America?
The priorities are essentially the same. The ways of dealing with the issues will vary enormously from place to place and even within communities, obviously, in the United States. The basic challenges are the same. For example, how to provide good preventive services and to link them with other health services and systems. How to learn from experience already gained so as to continue to move forward and not just kind of repeat ourselves. How to consider some of the underlying problems, which are remarkably similar in every society, problems which must be faced if we're going to face AIDS successfully. For example, problems of access to healthcare services, drugs and treatments. Problems of sex education. This is a universal problem, not just a problem in one particular place. Problems of the role and status of women. It's clear the epidemic is increasingly involving women in many different ways, and the role and status of women are inseparable from considering the ways in which AIDS prevention and control need to go forward. So there's actually a cluster of pre-existing, long-standing issues in just about every country which need to be faced in the context of AIDS, and therefore the agenda in fighting AIDS actually has, at a broad level, many similarities, and yet the individual ways in which these things will go forward will necessarily vary enormously from place to place.
Can you elaborate on how the role and status of women are connected to stopping the spread of AIDS?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, women are affected by the epidemic in three ways. There are women who are infected, and of the 10 million people in the world infected today, nearly 4 million now are women. Secondly, there is the additional problem of the spread of HIV infection from an infected woman to her fetus or newborn, which is an additional concern for women. And third, women are the major caregivers in both the formal and informal healthcare systems around the world. So AIDS is increasingly going to affect women, but let's be very specific. In terms of prevention, to just isolate one specific behavior, a woman really cannot say no to unwanted or unprotected sexual intercourse unless she also has the political, economic, and social power to mean no. Now, this is a fundamental issue and problem. And I mentioned earlier some work that's being done in Uganda to help change the laws involving property after divorce. Because if a woman who is divorced has no property, then her capacity or her ability to say no to unwanted or unprotected sex, it virtually vanishes because you're talking about survival. In fact, I'd even go so far as to say that when you look, that what AIDS really tells us and shows us is that around the world, that a male-dominated society is a threat to public health.
How so?
It's a threat to public health because when women do not have equal status and role, capacity, they are not able to take the steps that they need to take first as individuals and that they can also take on behalf and with the community as a whole to prevent HIV infection. If a woman is not able to say no, or if a woman is in a position where she has, in some cases, virtually no option but to enter the sex industry in order to survive, or if a woman is unable to insist that a condom be used, or if the sexuality practices are directed by and dominated by men, then we are describing a situation in which women will not be able to play a full active role to protect themselves, to protect their families, to protect others.
What are some of the things you always feel like you want Americans to know, you know, since you've been around the world, since you've studied AIDS around the world, and you've seen its different patterns and different cultures, whereas most of us in America are just thinking about the spread of AIDS here and the patterns it's developed here. What are some of the things you want to tell us?
I think there's really, thanks for the question, I think there's really one, for me, there's sort of one basic message, which is that the world today is an interdependent world in health. That is to say that what happens in health in other places can rapidly affect what happens to us here. What's happened more generally is that the dramatic increases, the unprecedented increases in the movements of people and ideas and goods around the world in the last quarter century has really created a new qualitative reality. This is a global world to an extent that has never existed before. People in communications and people in business have understood this for quite some time, but in health, we've been slower to understand this. What AIDS points out more than anything else is that a seemingly obscure health event in a faraway place can become a health crisis here in the next few years, that we have to act and think and react and develop our thinking along a global perspective in which interdependence and transcending, if you will, national borders becomes a critical part of our thinking. Just as you can't talk about a local or national economy these days without reference to a global economy, we can't think anymore about health, even in our community, let alone in our state or in our nation, without considering what is happening in health worldwide. I think this is the dominant message, if you will. It's the critical insight of our time to recognize that this global interdependence links together health and human rights. It links together health and solidarity, and it links together health and peace.
What kind of new cooperation does this realization of global interdependence require?
Well, it requires, first of all, a change of thinking where the theme that's been put forward in environmental action is, I think, quite appropriate. The think globally, act locally concept, I think, is very important. I think we also have to recognize that, for example, the AIDS epidemic was discovered in 1981 in the United States. I would propose, though perhaps there isn't time to discuss this in detail, that the epidemic could easily have escaped our attention or our knowledge for at least another 5 to 10 years, with great consequences for global health. This reminds us that the world now provides the conditions in which there can be globalization of epidemic disease in a way that had really not existed before. So we have to set up a global surveillance system, a global thinking about how we can identify new threats to health as they emerge so that we can respond as rapidly as possible as a community. In other words, helping other people in other countries becomes a part of helping ourselves. And that's the difference between solidarity and charity. And what a global interdependent view of health requires is thinking about global solidarity and mutual support and learning from each other, rather than a charity-based idea that we'll help those other people because of some general ideas about what's good, rather than also recognizing how much we need them and they need us.
Jonathan Mann, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jonathan Mann is the founder of the Global AIDS Policy Coalition, the chair of the 1992 International AIDS Conference, and the director of the International AIDS Center at Harvard University. This is Fresh Air.